Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's not-quite-weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Zoe Power.
I'm Sammy Smart.
I'm Ian Tong.
It's Thursday, June 7th at 5:01 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This week, the hills of Vancouver are alive with chatter about municipal politics and heated housing debates. We'll be digging into these topics in today's show, with original reporting from Sunday evening's NPA meeting, where the party locked in their candidate for this year's mayoral election. News Collective comrades Alex and Zubin covered this event, as well as interviewing Kirk Lapointe, who ran for the NPA's as the NPA's candidate for mayor in the 2014 election, about new directions for the party and for municipal politics since the time of his own campaign.
Next, we'll hear from Alex and Aiden, who attended an event held by Hector Bremner and interviewed him and two attendees about his plans going forward without the NPA. To end the show, we turn to a topic that's defining political platforms for the 2018 election, housing policy. News Collective comrades Ruben and Zubin bring you updates from Monday evening's Town Hall on Housing, hosted by MLA David Ebby, who's recently come under a lot of attack for the province's proposed school tax on homes worth more than $3 million.
And our absent but beloved comrade Alex DeBoer interviews Alex Hemingway of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about that controversial tax, as well as broader income equality in British Columbia and across Canada. But first, we're bringing you headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Over to you, Andy.
Vancouver to ban conversion therapy by the end of the summer. Conversion therapy is a widely discredited practice of attempting to change a patient's sexual orientation or gender identity through counseling, behavior modification, and sometimes even medication. Wednesday's Vancouver Council meeting saw the unanimous approval of a motion that added the business of providing conversion therapy to Vancouver's business prohibition bylaw. The ban covers both youth and adult therapies and follows the precedent set by Ontario, Manitoba, and the EU, all of whom have similar bans in place. The bylaw is in the process of being drafted and will be put into force within a few months. We don't have a set date for that yet, but we will hopefully soon. Conversion therapy is seen as deeply psychologically damaging and faces opposition from both the World Health Organization and the Canadian Psychological Association. It's really difficult to tell how prevalent the therapy is in BC, as medical professionals rarely offer it, and instead patients are mostly recruited by word of mouth and are treated by faith-based practitioners.
Squamish-based company says it can suck carbon air and make fuel. Through carbon engineering, a Squamish-based clean energy company published an article in the peer-reviewed journal Joule outlining its method of direct air capture process. The process enables carbon dioxide to be removed from the atmosphere and then combine with hydrogen and oxygen to create fuel. While at least seven different companies are working on similar initiatives globally, Carbon Engineering believes it can do the same for a fraction of the cost due to its use of already commercially available equipment. A Swiss-based organization, Climeworks, has already built a commercialized size plant. However, it costs them approximately $600 a ton to remove carbon from the atmosphere, while Carbon Engineering says it can do the job for between $94 US and $232 a ton. The company currently pulls about 1 ton of carbon a day from the air, creating 2 barrels of fuel, which costs about 25% more than the conventional oil-based gasoline. The plant uses some natural gas, giving a carbon footprint 70% lower than fossil fuel production. If the plant were electric or wind or solar powered, the fuel would be nearly carbon neutral. Carbon Engineering plans to build a full-scale plant within the next 2.5 years.
And fentanyl test strips sell for $1.25 at a Vancouver dollar store. The tests are made by Rapid Self-Test Incorporated, and the strips were discovered and tested by Sarah Blythe, a volunteer at the Overdose Prevention Society. She tested several different types of illicit street drugs and found that everything tested positive for fentanyl. However, the results could also be the result of false positives. The testing strips are similar to the ones used at InSight, the supervised consumption site in Vancouver. While not knowing how reliable the tests are, Blythe does think it's a good idea that the tests are accessible at a reasonable price, and she adds that it's just one more step in harm reduction to prevent overdose deaths. However, the tests don't test for carfentanil, a drug 100 times more potent than fentanyl. Health Canada warned last December that there was a possibility for false negatives with test strips. However, they were unavailable for comment on this story. More than 1,400 British Columbians died last year from illicit drug overdoses, and hundreds more have died this year, with fentanyl being believed to be responsible for most of those deaths.
And those were headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Thank you for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be right back with more local, uncovered news after this short break.
Music Waste Festival is stoked to present its first ever showcase featuring all bands with queer-identifying members. Come to the show Saturday, June 9th at 255 East 2nd Ave. There will be killer punk bangers and the chance to get down to some awesome electronic tunes. Featured artists are Strange Breed, Anybody's, Pudding, Killarissa, and Devours. Entry is $7 or free with your Music Waste Festival pass. National Indigenous Peoples Day is June 21st, and CITR 101.9 FM is here to provide you a day of special programming and celebration, with programs on language revitalization, Inuit composers, and much, much more. All day, CITR will be broadcasting content by, with, and for Canada's Indigenous people, from Indigenous-focused music playlists and audio documentaries to in-studio interviews. Tune in Thursday, June 21st from 11 a.m. onwards to hear all of CITR's programming on Indigenous culture, identity, and heritage.
And we're back.
Here we are at the Hellenic
You're listening
Center.
To Democracy Watch.
In Shaughnessy.
You're listening to several renditions of Democracy Watch at the same time on CITR 101.9 FM. And the News Collective's weekly current affairs show is playing. We just listened to headlines and will now turn to some original reporting from the NPA's electoral nomination meeting on Sunday, as well as to an interview with former NPA candidate Kirk Lapointe.
Here we are at the Hellenic Center in Shaughnessy. It is a Greek hall.
Located beside the lovely Quilchena Park.
Ooh, very nice area. Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's a city councilor. Are we leading ourselves?
It's a sunny Sunday evening when myself and News Collective member Zubin arrive at the Hellenic Center. We walk up to the media table and are immediately asked, "Are you from CITR?" "How did you know?" we reply. Apparently our youthful demeanor gave us away. The Hellenic Center, a Greek hall, is being rented for the Nonpartisan Association, or NPA's, mayoral nomination meeting. It's filled with rows of Mediterranean blue chairs awaiting an audience. The NPA is Vancouver's center-right municipal party, a party that complicates the right by being fiscally conservative but socially liberal. It's also the oldest party in the city and the party that's held the most control of City Hall over the last 80 years. This year, election year, the NPA has dealt with infighting. Their own sitting city councillor, Hector Bremner, who was elected in Vancouver's 2017 by-election, had his bid to run as the party's mayoral candidate rejected by the party itself. On this Sunday, June 3rd at 6 p.m., the three approved NPA mayoral nominees are about to deliver speeches to party members who will then cast a ballot for their chosen representative.
Beginning with Glenn Sherman, thanks very much.
The first speaker is Glenn Sherman, who the media have labeled a populist. He starts things off by asserting that he is both an outsider and a bringer of change to the NPA's old guard.
Doing the same things. I am that change. I'm a local. But I'm also not part of the establishment. Some have labeled me as an outsider. The truth is, we're right. My friend Kenny has said that he wants a city review. And as smart as Kenny is, and he is incredibly smart, what Kenny is really saying is that he needs to spend 4 years learning what I already know.
Next is John Cooper, the party's seeming frontrunner. A two-term park board member with the support of party insiders and former NPA mayor Philip Owen. He promises even-handedness and pragmatism if elected.
Do you know that we have not built a community center, a rink, or a pool since 2010? And how often have you walked around your city and said, that's not good enough, that's not clean enough, that's not safe enough? We need public amenities and solid infrastructure to make our city livable.
Last is Ken Sim, a local entrepreneur with no political experience, but the backing of Vancouver's business community. He steps down from the stage and walks up to the audience, talking about his humble beginnings, getting his first job as a night janitor at Wendy's, graduating from UBC, and becoming a chartered accountant.
My name is Ken Sim, and I was born at the old St. Vincent's Hospital. Like I said, we didn't have a mom. My mom was the primary breadwinner in our family, and she was the tightest.
After Sim's speech, Zubin and I head outside to chat with the nominees. Luckily, we're able to spend a few minutes with Ken Sim.
So, first of all, how do you feel that the speech went?
I think it went well. You know, it just came from the heart. That was just my life story, so, and how I feel. So, it felt good.
Why did you decide to speak so much about your life and your experience?
Well, I think every Vancouverite has their own story and they can relate to it. And, you know, it was just, you know, how I felt, why I love the city and why I want to help change, you know, the direction of our city to get us back on track. You know, it was just my personal story and I thought it was important.
And could you speak a bit about how you plan on keeping businesses in the city?
Well, you know, we're going to have to get rid of a lot of regulatory red tape, and we have to do things that make it easier for businesses to get by in the city. And so we'll do a deep dive, and we'll look at everything that affects businesses. We'll consult with businesses, and I'm a business owner, and so I already know a couple of things that are frustrating for us that really hurt us. And so, you know, we'll deal with them. One of the things is permitting. It's taking way too long to get a building permit, and when that happens, businesses, they struggle to get off the ground. You know, there are lots of cases where, you know, the most recent one is there's a Thai restaurant on 41st Avenue, and we used to go to this Thai restaurant all the time, and there was a fire there, and so they're looking for a permit just to rebuild their existing restaurant, and the delay took so long that they just said enough's enough and they gave up, and so that Thai restaurant's never coming back, and it's a shame. You know, we can do a lot better.
Right. So better permitting and like lower property taxes, things like that.
You know, we're gonna look at everything, and we'll see, you know, what are the big things that are really frustrating businesses, and we'll start working on them one at a time.
What did you think of Glenn Chernin's comment that it would take you and John 4 years to learn what he already knew?
No, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but like I've run companies before. I was a chartered accountant, so I have the skills. And I think, that, you know, at the end of the day, it's about being able to ask the right questions and putting teams together who know how to do things. And so that's my skill. I'm great at putting teams together, and it won't take very much time at all to review the financials, to see where a lot of the waste is, but also to see where the opportunities are. And that's what we'll do.
And I noticed on a brief summary of your platform that you did mention improving conditions in the downtown east side, such as more housing. I think you were the only of the three candidates to mention that. Why do you think the downtown east side is an important issue in Vancouver?
Well, I don't think it's just the downtown east side here. We're talking about mental health and addictions. And having spoken to residents across the city, it's a big issue that we need to address. But when it comes to the downtown east side, it's dear to my heart. I know three people personally who ended up in the downtown east side. My mom got really sick, and if it wasn't for family support, she could have ended up in the downtown east side. I used to walk around the downtown east side as a kid. You know, and it's frustrating because I know over $1 million goes into the downtown east side every day. So over a mayor's term, that's almost $1.5 billion that goes into the downtown east side. And people care about the downtown east side, so there must be a better way. It's not from a lack of resources. You know, I'm not saying it's not a complex issue. It's a very complicated issue. But we should be able to make some headway in improving the situation for our most vulnerable residents.
In a similar vein to what you were discussing about the businesses, what kind of measures would you like to take to encourage, as you described it, the best and brightest of Vancouver to remain in Vancouver?
How much time do you have? Well, there are a lot of things that are affecting, like that will make people consider leaving our city. One's affordability. Another one's opportunity. And so if we work on those two issues right there, I think we'll make a lot of headway. But, you know, there aren't any simple solutions. It will take time. And so, you know, we'll work on it.
Zubin and I leave our spot at the media table as other journalists order pizza and dig in for the next few hours as votes get counted. At home a few hours later, I learn from Twitter that Ken Sim has emerged victorious. A bit of a surprise for everyone. He received almost 50% of the vote. John Cooper came second with around 30%, and Glenn Chernin came last with about 20%. Of the roughly 4,500 NPA members, only 1,960 voted. Although the civic election is in October and it's only June, Ken Sim will no doubt be a viable frontrunner for the mayorship, as the NPA has historically been a leader in Vancouver's civic politics. Democracy Watch will continue to follow the election closely, so stay tuned for our reports. Thank you for listening. This story was reported by Alex DeBoer and Zubin Shroff Marabadi. It was edited and produced by Alex DeBoer. Stay tuned now for an interview with the NPA's 2014 mayoral candidate and UBC Journalism School professor, Kirk Lapointe, who took a few minutes after the NPA speeches to share with Democracy Watch his thoughts on the state of the NPA and local politics more generally. Yeah. Here's our interview with Kirk.
Tell us who you voted for?
No. I voted for a man this time. Yeah, I voted for a man.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's as close as I can tell you.
Yes.
Yeah. No, actually, I actually depended on, I wanted to listen to the speeches quite carefully. That's why I can't. I could have easily voted some other time during the day. I thought speeches were important. I think that, you know, in an ideal world, I think you wouldn't be able to vote until the speeches were done. But you know, I think it's good. It's healthy. Healthy group.
Well, how do you think the NPA has changed since you ran for mayor?
Yeah, it's gone through some challenges. I think that, you know, it's never been really a party. I mean, we actually changed the bylaws after the last election to make it an official party. But it's usually been one of these things where people begin to get together about 6 months before the election and raise money and find some candidates and do all that. And I think the party this time wanted to actually have more continuity, but it wasn't really able to. And so only in about the last year have you started to see it come back that way. And that's healthy, because if we have a party system in the city, you can't just show up with 4, 5, 6 months to go. I found that out in 2014. It was really tough. I was announced with 4 months to a day to go to the vote. And, you know, we had to find our money. Like, there were, in the early going of our campaign, we were not spending money because we didn't have it coming in yet. And we were watching other parties like just spend like crazy, and so even then it took until we got momentum. So it's healthy this time. They've got enough time to get the money together to have a reasonable campaign and to be on equal footing with the other parties, so that's good. It'll be healthy that way.
Do you think changes in campaign financing will affect the proceedings of this campaign election campaign, sorry?
Yeah, very definitely. I think the last three, I guess, campaigns have been really influenced heavily by single donors or by, say, a handful of donors. And look, I mean, when I ran in 2014, I made it clear to people, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be beholden to you. I'm not going to, you know, you may be very benevolent, but, you know, that's not going to do anything. But I think the public perception is that it can make you susceptible to that. And so what these campaign rules have done is flatten it out where nobody is particularly more important than anybody else. And the cap of $1,200, say, in contributions, even for people who have a lot of money and who have a lot of friends that they'll just give $1,200 to, that's still not going to make, a really, really significant amount. And I think that perception is reality in a lot of cases. You know, I teach ethics and leadership, and we talk about conflicts of interest, and perceived conflicts are every bit as important as the real ones. And so anything you can do to mitigate the perceived conflict, and a real one, of course, it's good. It's good for you.
I'm curious because Glenn Chernin was also running for mayor in 2014, but under the
Cedar Party. Yeah. He was actually an opponent of mine, and I think what he probably recognized was that it's very tough to come from that far away to the mayoralty position. You know, I was very fortunate to get as many votes as I did in 2014, but a lot of it had to do with the machinery of a party and the fact that you've got people who have been volunteering and volunteering and volunteering. And ultimately, they make a big difference. You can't just have a couple of dozen people helping you out. You need hundreds. And, yeah, so I think he sensed that was important for him to do, get inside the party, even though he's been, you know, he calls himself a bit of a disruptor, but the fact is that he still has to then operate with the entire party machinery at some point if he gets the nomination tonight. And you really can't go to ground zero on this stuff. You've got to use a lot of the people who have been very used to helping over the years, over the decades in some cases. You know, there are people here who have been working for the party for 25, 30 years. You know, it's pretty amazing. So.
Would you describe the NPA as a party on the right?
I think it's center-right. I certainly attempted to move it into the center. I mean, I'm much more progressive probably than a chunk of the party. And it's a progressive city. I don't think you can win from the right. You can sort of see at a provincial and a federal level there just aren't enough conservatives in the city to elect people. That being said, at a municipal level, when you have a lower turnout, sometimes it comes down to making sure that your base turns out for you. So I think, you know, at times it's looked as if the party can win with a conservative base, but I don't think that's the case anymore. I think people are properly disappointed with the kind of progressive performance, but I think in their hearts they want environmentally sensitive. They want policies that are inclusive. They want policies that are intervening at the right places with government. And so they're not all anti-taxes. That's just not who they are. They're after kind of a common sense administration. And that isn't particularly right of center. That's actually pretty centrist, you know. Yeah.
We're just briefly catching on that. Do you think this election will bring out more voters than recent ones?
I think because it's pretty wide open. Yeah. I think people in the last election perceived I was a total newcomer. And I think some people thought, well, there's no way he's going to win. So I think that, but even then, you know, the voter turnout went from 34% in 2011 to 43, nearly 44. And it would be great if there is a turnout of more than 50%. I think there's going to be a lot of people vying for the mayoralty and a lot of prominent enough candidates. Last time, there were really only three of us that were prominent. I think this time you'll see five, maybe six prominent candidates, and that's bound to get people because they'll all have their constituencies, and that'll be probably healthy. And so once you're there, you got to start ticking the box for council and ticking the box for park board and ticking the box for school board. So that's going to be healthy, I think. That'll be good. Yeah, it's a good question.
All right. Thank you to News Collective comrades Alex and Zubin for braving the trip to the Hellenic Club to bring us that original report from Sunday evening. Alex, unfortunately, isn't here. Shout out to Alex DeBoer, our greatest fan, listening from the east side. But Zubin is here with us in the studio. And Zubin, your report mentioned that when the nomination was announced, you guys were surprised that Ken Sim won. Can you tell us a bit more about why that's the case?
Well, of course, he has no prior political experience, and John Cooper, out of the three, being the only nominee who did have any experience as a current Parks Board member. So Ken Sim definitely was like, from my just observant point of view, was like the second favorite when I was there during the meeting. Chernin definitely didn't look like he was popular to those present, but he still got 20% of their votes. But I guess the NPA members who voted decided they wanted some change, maybe a fresh face, and I guess Ken Sim offered that to them.
Yeah, my understanding was that Cooper is kind of this, like, establishment candidate who pissed off a lot of people when he voted against having whales and dolphins on display in the aquarium. So there's these really powerful lobbies in Vancouver who now don't want him to be mayor, and that was maybe threatening his nomination.
I unfortunately don't know much about that aspect, but he definitely, definitely seen him presented as the established candidate beforehand, and like he definitely had that feeling, like his speech, like he goes up, like there was a lot more applause for him, like there was like more clear recognition of who he was initially. I don't know enough of the backstory about those votes, but although I know his big thing, he talked about it during his campaign speech, which he says got him into politics, was how he saved the Bloedel Conservatory. Which is a big deal to him. But yeah, I don't know enough about the whales issue, which was a contentious issue, I know, in Vancouver some months ago now.
All right. Well, we are intending to continue reporting on the mayoral election throughout the summer, so expect more from our resident Ken Sim expert, Zubin, as the weeks go by. But we can't talk about the NPA, of course, without mentioning Hector Bremner, the incumbent NPA councillor who was rejected by his own party as a mayoral candidate and now looks to be striking out on his own instead. As Ken Sim's success in seeking the candidacy was announced on Sunday evening, Bremner tweeted the following. First, I would like to congratulate Ken Sim on becoming the NPA nominee, but Sim has won a poisoned chalice. This is now no longer the NPA as most people know it. Laying some punches there. Bremner then invited his supporters and those Vancouverites who were disenfranchised by the board of the NPA to come and join him in Charles Bar the following night to talk about the way forward. News Collective comrades Alex and Aiden were there chasing the news, as we do. And Aiden and Sammy have put together the following report from that event for your ears only.
Here we are at the Hellenic Center in Shaughnessy. It is a Greek hall.
Located beside the lovely Quilchena Park.
Ooh, very nice area. Pretty sure she's a city councilor. Are we leading ourselves?
It's a sunny Sunday evening when myself and News Collective member Zubin arrive at the Hellenic Center. We walk up to the media table and are immediately asked, "Are you from CITR?" "How did you know?" we reply. Apparently our youthful demeanor gave us away.
After Ken Sim was chosen as the NPA's mayoral candidate the previous day, Hector Bremner, a sitting NPA city councillor, held a meeting at a downtown bar. He sent out a call on Twitter after Sim was elected, saying Sim had inherited a poison chalice and opened his meeting up to both his supporters and those disenfranchised with the party who are desperate for housing and hope in the city.
Something. It's really easy to stand in the shadows. It's really easy to say, I'm not going to commit. But you're committing, and look at you. This is beautiful. This is amazing. Obviously, people feel like there's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of anger out there with how things went with us, but just in politics in general in Vancouver. And why wouldn't you be frustrated? Our housing crisis is out of control. Small businesses are under pressure. Seniors are leaving. Young people are leaving. Families can't make it in Vancouver. And why? Because we've been saying no to families, and we've been saying no to solutions, and we've been not willing to stand for something. Anything. There's no easy way out of what's going on in Vancouver. But the only way we will get there is when we say our voice is bigger than the hate. It's not going to be hate and blame or tax and ban. It's going to be hope and a plan that we need to bring a word back into politics that's not said a lot.
Yes.
Democracy Watch reporters Alex DeBoer and Aiden Tong were there interviewing Hector Bremner as well as a few of the attendees. We talked to Hector Bremner about his plans going forward in the mayoral election.
I was wondering if you could tell us anything about the new civic party you're planning on starting. I know the specifics are coming up at the end of June, but if there's any...
The notion at the moment is that if you are really going out and you're actually listening to what people are saying, and if you're looking at a lot of the polling and you're looking at all of the analysis and you're reading what's being said in the articles and you're reading what people are saying on social media, it's people who are really done with politics as usual. And I know that's been said before, but really at this time, this election, in this city at this moment, that is more true than ever. And you've seen a collapse of Vision Vancouver, which has been the governing party for a long time. They have collapsed. I would argue that the NPA is collapsing based on partially the way they handled things with me, and they had an opportunity for a revival and a renewal and a rebirth to go back to where when they were successful, which was when they were a Big Ten party and they were welcoming of more people, but they said, no, we're going to do, you know, a big C conservative effort, and, you know, we're going to really focus on being on the right, and it's our turn to govern. And I don't think that really connects with people. So in saying all that, we feel that there's a space and an imperative, not just a need, but an imperative to offer something to people that's non-ideological. It's in the center. It's welcoming to people on the left, right. It's really not about left or right, of course. It's about forward or backwards. And our city really needs to move forward on some very critical issues.
In the interview with Bremner, he discussed his concerns with the NPA and his motivation to form a new party.
And there's been this tendency that when things start going well, particularly if you're not willing to toe the line of a pretty small group, you get turfed. And, you know, I was willing to have that fight. I was willing to have that debate because I believe it's critical that we need to speak for more than just 1% of people. We need to speak for everybody. And, you know, this is really not about my political career. I recognize that there's some risks that I'm taking in all of this. But I didn't get elected to just be elected. I got elected to do the job. And that's why I fought for Northwest Burnt Grey. And that's why I've been fighting for more housing and more common sense solutions and moving our city forward in a much bolder way. And I believe the vast majority of people support that. And I think if you go out there and you talk to the electorate, they support that.
Hector Bremner expressed his concerns with the current state of politics in Vancouver, noting his concern with their priorities and actions, as well as the undertone of division and fear.
It's all press releases, and my problem with Vision and the rest of it. It's press releases over really priorities. It's you know, we're going to ban straws, but we're still going to, you know, build single-family detached homes right next to SkyTrain stations. There's just a lack of focus, and nothing seems to be really taken seriously right now in Vancouver. And myself and a lot of people are tired of that, and we think that it's time to say yes to the good ideas, to say yes to each other, to say that we cannot blame some to have it all. We can't just blame, you know, Chinese people, for example, taking a big brunt of the housing crisis woes, and this is a historical problem. We can't blame developers, or we can't blame, you know, homeless people for other problems. It's time to stop blaming everyone and understand that we don't manage our resources very well in terms of a land base. We don't manage our public resources very well in terms of how we put tax dollars on the road and get services to people and how we manage those services. We're usually serving the system rather than people. And we're trying to treat symptoms instead of curing a disease.
One attendee we spoke to, Nick Steffen, is a disenfranchised member of the NPA. He told us why he supports Hector Bremner.
Hector Bremner has resonated with me the most for charisma and relatability and trying to possibly bridge a gap of distrust between politicians that don't seem genuine. I feel like I can relate to Hector more than any other candidate currently.
Another attendee, Ken DeNike, former chair and trustee of the Vancouver School Board, expressed concerns about Ken Sim being the NPA mayoral nominee.
there is a candidate for NPA for mayor, somebody who isn't known, has had no political experience, and running, you know, what's of interest is that you look at the parameters that people look at for voting, and very seldom do they go for somebody with no experience. And, you know, basically a businessman, and he's involved with two companies, but beyond that, there's not really any experience in terms of civic, community, anything to do with housing. He was incredibly vague, and I think that's the big issue.
Ken DeNike is currently a member of the NPA, but plans on dropping his membership soon. While Hector Bremner hasn't fully created his platform, nor his new party, there is a sense of anticipation for what is to come. I'm Sammy Smart.
And I'm Aiden Tong.
Thanks for listening to Democracy Watch.
All right. Hi. Thank you guys for that awesome report. Sammy and Aiden are actually here with us live in studio to share a few more of their thoughts about Hector Bremner's meeting on Monday night.
Yeah, so I mean, he sounded like he's very well-spoken, but I will say, I mean, he came off like every other politician. He did give very valid points, but there was also points where he made extremely vague comments. So he wants to love Vancouver, and he wants to bring back the ethics and values that Vancouver traditionally always has, but like, what is that, and what does loving Vancouver mean? But I mean, what stood out for me was the fact that he does have a background where his family was middle. He told me his family was middle to upper class, and then they lost everything, and they were financially kind of deprived, and he was going through a decent amount of hard times throughout his childhood, and so that's what spoke out for me. And so I think Hector Bremner does have a shot, and sound like a pretty significant guy in this election.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see someone like breaking apart from a party they've been with for a long time, and like deciding to potentially start their own party and possibly run for mayor with that party. It's very unclear what's happening at this point. It's very vague. But I guess it's kind of exciting to think about what's to come with Hector Bremner and like everything he plans to do with the coming mayoral election.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, he doesn't really have like a consolidated platform yet, but I'm excited to see what that will become, what the result will be.
Right on. Yeah, and the hashtag of Hector Bremner's independent platform is hashtag Let's Fix Housing, which is the topic that we will be returning to on Democracy Watch after this short break.
Shout out to Alex.
Alex DeBoer.
After Ken Sim was chosen as the NPA's mayoral candidate the previous day,
Hub Cycling is hosting Bike to Shop Days. On June 22nd to June 24th, come out and get advice on the gear and techniques that allow you to easily use your bike for shopping trips. There will be route maps for shopping, celebration stations, which have info, snacks, and free bike tune-ups, discounts at local shops around Metro Vancouver, a passport challenge where participants collect stamps at celebration stations to win prizes, guided rides, and riding to local stores to show support. Check out bikehub.ca for more information.
The BC government now covers medications that could reduce your chances of contracting HIV by 90%. PREP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis and is a preventative measure that HIV-negative folks can take to reduce their risk of becoming positive. Health Initiative for Men suggests that if you have had sex with a partner with HIV, have had a recent STI, have multiple sexual partners, have a history of inconsistent or no condom use, are currently involved in sex work, or have had repeated courses of post-exposure prophylaxis, then you might want to think about looking into PREP measures. CATR and Discorder are not medical professionals. Please refer to your doctor for more information.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, the News Collective's weekly undercovered current affairs program. Today, we've heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, as well as original reporting from Sunday night's NPA mayoral nomination meeting and Hector Bremner's rival event the evening after. We'll now turn our attention to another hot political issue, that of housing affordability in the city of Vancouver, and in particular, the school tax laid out by the NDP in their latest budget, which has homeowners in Vancouver's wealthiest neighborhoods all riled up and reaching for the picket signs. Ruben and Zubin attended a town hall posted by David Eby on Monday evening, and we're going to play their reporting from that event for you right now.
On Monday, June 4th, MLA and Attorney General David Eby hosted an event titled Housing Town Hall 2.0 at the Hellenic Center located in the Arbutus Ridge area. The event consisted of a panel discussion followed by a town hall Q&A session. The panel appointed by David Eby included UBC Professor Margot Young of the Allard School of Law, Professor Paul Kershaw of the School of Population and Public Health, David Stroud, a mortgage specialist, and economics professor Reese Kesselman of SFU, as well as local resident Sarah Monroe.
There were both supporters and opponents of the increase in property tax at this event. Most vocal attendants were local residents of nearby neighborhoods such as Point Grey, who spoke up against the increase of their property taxes in general. Although the event became quite calmly, by the end, there were lots of jeering and clapping and audible frustration, mainly from those who opposed the tax and David Eby himself.
Prior to the event commencing, a rally against the tax increase was held in nearby Quilchena Park. A couple people who were leaving this rally told us that they were there because they were afraid of class warfare and believed they were already being asked to pay an unfair amount of taxes.
Actually, we paid a lot more than the normal people. I mean, yeah, we already paid a lot. Why should we pay more? I mean, they separate the class.
So this is not tax. This is the class warfare.
Someone mentioned the age demographics of the town hall meeting attendants, asking if anyone next to them were under 30 and whether they were renters or not. However, it seems that both sides understood the general issue about the housing market.
I think, you know, one of the things I think we can all agree on, whether, you know, despite having some, you know, differences of opinion on the school tax, is that housing prices have gone up in a very unhealthy manner. I think we've seen a lot of negative behaviors associated with this as well.
Many opponents of this tax increase suggested the policy was unfair as their incomes may not be equivalent with their property values and that their houses are wealth that they have not yet benefited from.
When we took out a big mortgage to buy our little house, it felt like a big risk. And that risk was all ours. But the potential gain would be all ours too. We could have lost it all, and we still could lose it. You can't reckon your gains until you sell out. The escalating property tax on appreciating homes feels like the province is trying to retroactively grab some of the current value we've gained through our home investment without ever having shared in our risk. That is not fair.
In response to the foreign buyer ban, Eby suggested that it was not an easy problem to solve.
On the foreign buyer ban, it's a tricky one because a lot of the capital that's coming into our housing market is actually coming in from people that have either permanent residency or citizenship status. So if you do a foreign buyer ban, what it does is it advantages people who are speculating and it actually inhibits people who are coming to work here.
Someone who supported the tax mentioned that this quote-unquote unearned revenue needs to be redistributed amongst the community and that rental tenants needed better legal conditions. After the town hall meeting had ended, we gathered a couple debriefing interviews. One local woman who was a renter was surprised to see so many angry homeowners. Another local woman told us that she was in favor of the tax and was willing to pay more.
I thought it was amazing. I came to listen because I had read about all these lottery winners with their golden pitchforks, and I couldn't actually really believe it, but I was astounded at how angry people were at the fact that people are coming after their money for a relatively small amount of money. And actually, I was amazed because I rent. Everybody I know rents. And a lot of my friends have kids. They're raising their kids in closets. And they have no housing security. And then so I go to this room with people who are the only people I know in Vancouver who have housing security. And they're all so mad.
I thought it was very interesting. I thought the front of the room was full of all the seniors and other residents who agree with David Eby, and the back was packed with booers. And unfortunately, those of us who are not upset with him didn't have a motivation to speak, and now I wish I had, because most of the people who spoke were very angry. And I don't agree with them. I'm a homeowner. I made a ton of money on my home. I don't mind sharing some of it.
This town hall meeting demonstrated how housing is the main issue for Vancouver's upcoming mayoral election, regardless of where Vancouverites live or how wealthy they are. Discussions surrounding this increased tax will most likely continue. However, it seems that for now, the NDP government intends to implement it starting in 2019.
All right, and we are back on Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We are lucky enough to be joined live in studio by the dream team of Zubin and Ruben, who put that report together. And you're going to tell us a bit more about their experience at the town hall on Monday evening.
It's definitely an interesting experience as a lifelong Vancouverite, seeing, I guess, some of my fellow neighbors a lot more riled up than I've probably ever seen. So, yeah, definitely interesting experience. These are definitely probably the kind of folks you wouldn't see it at your normal kind of rally, but when it comes to property taxes, I guess, yeah. Well, I thought my general takeaway is, like, housing is the central issue of this upcoming civic election, regardless of how wealthy or not you are.
And I think one thing that could have been more engaging or interesting would have more panels that might be opposed to David Eby or the school tax, because it was weird to see that all the panels were at least somewhat agreeing with David Eby. And I think that if we had some opposition on the panels, we would have had a little bit more of a critical discussion or a conversation about the topic. And yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it certainly, I mean, it seems as though there's enough opposition to Eby's tax out there, especially in West Point Grey anyway. Yeah. And it seems like they were really taking this opportunity to, like, push the policy and defend it. Is that?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, yeah, the panel members he brought were definitely generally in support. Like, he had a couple, two university, like, UBC professors and Professor Emeritus from SFU, who were pretty in favor, basically boiling down to, like, people have expensive homes, these need to be taxed more, and that'll be better for society in general. But yeah, there was definitely also then, I think, a lot of people that came there to jeer at David Eby. And as one of the women we spoke to afterwards pointed out, like, most of the people that probably attended this town hall to criticize the tax are likely people that didn't vote for Eby in the first place.
Yeah, well, certainly won't be next time, now they've got their pickets up outside their homes. Yeah. All right, thank you so much to the two of you guys for your amazing original reporting on that event. We're going to turn now to, still on the topic of housing, an original interview from News Collective comrade Alex DeBoer. Shout out to Alex, who interviewed this week Alex Hemingway from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about specifically this controversial property tax, but also other questions of taxation and wealth inequality, both here in Vancouver, BC, and more generally across Canada. So we'll play that interview for you now.
Okay, I'll just shoot then. Thanks for taking the time to answer my questions. I won't keep you long. Basically, as you know, the sort of motivation behind this question is the NDP's February budget, which included a school tax, which takes form as an increase on property tax and property transfer tax on homes worth over $3 million. So this property tax has caused some antagonism between sort of left-leaning groups such as housing advocacy groups like Housing Action for Local Taxpayers, and on the other side there's residents in Vancouver's West Side, and these residents have been very vocal about their disapproval and expressed it also last Sunday in a town hall with Attorney General David Eby. So what I found interesting about this story was just the simple fact that the people in the west side of Vancouver don't seem to be actually generally that rich, a lot of them. They're like middle to upper middle class people, and so still definitely like well off, but middle class incomes in Vancouver range from like $31,000 a year to like $137,000, and then upper middle class is more like $200,000 to maybe $400,000. Is that correct?
I don't know if it depends how you define those terms.
Yeah, if it's by...
I don't have those distribution numbers. But, you know, that's all very subjective, so that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, not to say that those people aren't well off, but looking at wealth distribution in Canada nationally, and I read that the top five Canadians own 30% of the nation's wealth. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about how this wealth gap in Canada is so large and why those people who are so profoundly wealthy aren't the ones having their wealth redistributed on a much more significant scale.
Right, yeah. Well, I think both are actually pretty important. So,
yeah.
And you alluded to this already. There is an issue where the way we discuss class and upper income distribution. So to answer your question, I think first of all, we do want to ask the way we stop and consider the way we think about class, and income is just one dimension of that. So I think it is appropriate to look at the wealth piece as well. Income inequality in Canada is extreme. Wealth inequality is much, much worse. So we want to bring okay. both of those into our analysis. Now, in terms of this housing issue, I think you flagged something important here. There is essentially a super rich class in this country, as there are in most developed countries, and taking a hard look at the wealth accumulation that's happening at the very top, as well as the concentration of income, that's important, and we shouldn't miss that, and nor should we, you know, in looking at things like land and housing wealth in Vancouver, we shouldn't forget that even more extreme form of wealth. But I will say that the inequality that's flowing from land and housing wealth in Vancouver is actually at a pretty incredible scale as well. So if you look in, for example, in 2015, just the land, not including the building value, just under the single-family detached houses in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
Increased in value that year by $26 billion. And that's actually more than the total income from working in Vancouver that year. And the next year, that land value increased by $46 billion, so it was double the income from working. So the scale is quite large. Just to give you one more number on that, when you look at all of the residential land in Vancouver between, since 2006, that value has increased by about $170 billion. So
mm-hmm.
the scale is large, and so I do think it's appropriate to address that because it's distributed so unequally. When you see something like the school tax coming in on these properties over $3 million, that's actually targeting the top 2% of properties by value in the province. So I think that's a reasonable place to start if we're going to think about addressing that aspect of inequality.
Right. So then I guess one of the issues people have had with this is that it's a wealth tax versus like an income tax. So do you think taxes targeting wealth and property assets are a good way of redistribution, or do you think taxing income is better?
I think they're both they're both important. And, you know, wealth has typically received much less attention. And I think in part that's because the wealthiest people in our societies have been very successful at protecting their wealth from taxation. Now, in the case of housing, there's another reason why it's appropriate, I think, to use mechanisms like the school tax, and that's because property in Vancouver is actually taxed at a very low rate compared to the rest of the country. And one of the things that does is, you know, look, the property tax rate in Vancouver, the standard rate is about a quarter of 1%. And so what that means is, if you're an investor, if you're viewing the ownership of property as an investment, it has a very low carrying cost as a result of that low taxation. So one of the consequences of that is that investing in property becomes very attractive relative to other types of assets. So if you were going to invest in mutual funds instead, you're going to pay about 2% a year in management fees. Compare that to that quarter of 1% carrying costs for property. So that's one sort of negative spin-off effect of having low property taxes. But what we've always said at the CCPA, where I work, is that we should bring in progressivity, more fairness to our property tax system, the way we do with income tax, by taxing wealth at the very high end, property wealth at the very high end, at a higher rate than we do lower value properties.
Right. So then with that super wealthy demographic in Canada, which is very small, how are they able to be so wealthy? Is this like tax evasion, or, and again, this is probably a really ignorant question, but like how does one become that rich?
Yeah, that's a big question, and there's you know, major changes that have unfolded in our economy over the past number of decades that have helped create this situation. So we've seen, for example, big declines in the level at which we tax income, particularly at the high end. You know, developed countries, many developed countries had top tax rates for income at very high ends of the distribution, at 60, 70, 80%, even more in some cases, a few decades ago. We've moved away from that. Corporate taxes have been cut. Unionization rates have fallen. And that's a huge source of the ability for working people to negotiate for higher wages and retain more of that income that's produced in a given enterprise. So, you know, there's a whole range of interacting factors there. I think that starts you down the road of answering how we get to this, you know, really extreme levels of wealth inequality.
Right. Okay, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm just still left with the thought that there are people in Vancouver's west side that might have a property that's gone up significantly in value, but are sort of more cash poor or don't have an income. And so I think, like, I've listened to some call-in shows, and it seems like there are some people who genuinely aren't very wealthy, and so despite having a high-value property. So do you think that this school tax is perhaps going to be hard on some people, despite the fact that they have these high-value properties?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, I would just push back a little bit and say, you know, if you own a $4, $5, or $6 million property, you may not feel wealthy because of just the way you happen to acquire that wealth, but that is wealth, and you are actually very, very wealthy compared to most other folks in the city and in the province. And so I do think we've kind of got to start getting our head around that wealth in land is real wealth, but that's going to take some adjustment in the way we think about these things. In terms of the cash poor piece, you know, that's a great question. So in BC, we have a very generous or other circumstances. So that's one option. Another option is, so if you, so for example, if you bought a house 20 or 30 years ago, you know, for a shoestring, and now it happens to be worth $4 million, you know, that's lucky. You're likely over 55 at that point, so you can defer those property taxes if you like. If you happen to be in that in-between spot where you can't get access to that government deferral, but you've still benefited from, you know, a major appreciation, million or two or more dollars appreciation in your home value that's pushed you up above that $3 million threshold, you can also get a home equity loan that can help pay that tax. One interesting thing to note is that, so for example, if you have a $4 million property in Vancouver compared to in Toronto, even after this additional tax that's been brought in, you're going to be paying a much lower property tax bill on that $4 million property than you would be in Toronto. So in relative terms, again, we do have these very low property taxes, but I think, you know, we should make sure that people are able to manage in these situations. And I really haven't seen very many examples, concrete examples, where they wouldn't be able to. But, you know, in those outlier cases, we should look at it for sure.
Okay. And then I'm conscious of time, so I'll just ask one more question and then let you go.
Sure.
I'm just wondering what people can do to, I guess, maybe including or besides voting for parties who advocate for wealth redistribution, but what people can do to change the wealth gap in Canada, especially of the super wealthy, preventing that kind of like extreme hoarding of wealth. Like, is there anything that can be done?
Absolutely. It's a great question. I mean, you end up fighting against this dynamic where as wealth concentrates, political power often concentrates with it, because if you're super wealthy, you have so many more resources with which to try and influence the political process, not just donating to political parties. It's any number of things. It's lobbying. It's being able to help fund you know, different organizations that will put forward your point of view about how the world should work. So there is this imbalance in power that sort of leads to this self-reinforcing dynamic of concentrating wealth and concentrating political power. That can be disrupted, and it has at different points in history. And I think the common denominator there is the only thing that can go up against organized money is organized people, and there are far more, by definition, when you get into these situations of extreme inequality, there are far more people who are being hurt by this than being helped. And those folks getting organized, whether it's to pressure the government of the day, whether to run for a political party, whether to organize their workplace for better wages and working conditions, organize a new union, support the expansion of the union movement, or other types of community organizing groups. That's really the answer from my point of view. And you know, there's no shortcut to it, and there's no one single answer. But that type of baseline, grassroots, on the ground people power is really the only way to start reversing these trends. And you know, I would just say that I think the idea that something needs to be done about this is more widespread than ever. I think, you know, more than it was 10 or 20 years ago, I think people recognize that we need to do something about this. So it really is a question of getting into gear and getting into action and figuring out where in your life you can fit into contributing to that change.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for covering this this stuff. I mean, it needs to be talked about, so it's great.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you. All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Shout out to Alex Dubois for that wonderfully beautiful piece. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
All right. And that's it for Democracy Watch this week. Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. Please join us again next Thursday for more exciting local politics coverage and coverage of underrepresented issues from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.